So today's FAQ is on food and class politics. Because one or two members brought this up and mentioned it a couple of months ago. And we thought it'd be a good subject. Now, it just happens that a few weeks ago, some of you will have seen it, we showed a film on Discord called The Need to Grow, which was about an impending food crisis, or a supposed impending food crisis due to global soil degradation, which I've also written about in the forthcoming August Standard. Now, I had to sign up to see this film. It wasn't free on YouTube. You can't just go and watch it. You have to sign up to see it. And the reason for that is, I think, since then I've been deluged with helpful emails on all aspects of food, which I would mostly describe as spam that's trying to screw money out of me to finance private business concerns. And also something, but one I got today was from something called the Food Revolution Network. And I'll just quote a little bit for it. It says, "It all starts with the food you eat. Here are five foods you should avoid and nine you should eat a lot more of if you want." And then you can basically select your goal in life at that point. and this leads to our website, you know, giving you all sorts of information about food and food properties. And it all looks very well meant and, you know, very well researched from what I can see. Although, you know, if you really wanted unbiased advice about food and nutrition, you would probably be better off going to an unbiased scientific source rather than something with revolution in the title. But of course, it's all quite predictable. Don't eat anything you like. Eat lots of things you don't like. And also, in passing, I feel obliged to complain about how the notion of revolution gets hijacked as a lifestyle term, and all the political meaning taken out of it, so that people can enjoy a sort of, you know, cozy, self-congratulatory glow of calling themselves revolutionaries without having to do any real revolutionary work. In any case, the problem with this website is that they're preaching to the converted. The kind of people who will read this website and follow its advice are going to be the sort of people who already eat, you know, platefuls of what look like mushrooms and lawn mowings on the website. And it's not going to be read by people who like eating donuts, crisps and pizzas. But who eats what in society isn't random. There are historical reasons why workers tend to eat fast foods full of preservatives and additives, while the better off have better diets. Fast food additives and preservatives are particularly a feature of British working class life because they came in during the Industrial Revolution, when long working hours meant much less time for cooking at home. And because mass-cooked food tends to destroy all the vitamins in it, additives were put in. And because it needed to last, have a long shelf life, preservatives were put in. At least in Europe, in countries that didn't see any equivalent of the Industrial Revolution, you don't tend to see the same dietary patterns. So if you go to a Spanish or Italian supermarket, you'll see a small section for crisps and snacks, whereas if you go to a British supermarket, you see an entire aisle. The same goes for biscuits and chocolate. Now, capitalist firms have been manipulating diet for years, obviously for a profit. Just to give one example, sugar. It's thought by some scientists to be as addictive as cocaine, but you can't always tell you're eating it, because sugar isn't always obviously sweet. So you might, for example, look rather askance at somebody who heaped 5 teaspoons of sugar into a cup of tea, but you wouldn't think twice about eating a low-fat yogurt, which also contains 5 teaspoons of sugar. In the US, the average person's yearly consumption of sugar is about the weight of a moped or a small horse. Imagine if the food industry could get away with putting cocaine in the food. I mean, they did at one time until it was banned. And if they could get away with it, of course they would do it because, well, it would make them a ton of money. And we would all love it. We'd be getting off our heads every mealtime. And but then the middle-class healthy eaters and the do-gooders and the doctors would all be telling us to cut down on our diet because on our cocaine diet because it's making us all psychotic. And we wouldn't listen to them because, you know, life for workers is shit enough anyway and there's little enough pleasure to be had. According to the WHO, by 2050, 60% of men, 50% of women, 25% of children in the UK are expected to be obese. Some party members argue that what you eat is a personal choice, but these choices are managed and they're manipulated by the food industry. It's overwhelmingly workers who eat shit and die young. So diet is a class issue, which means that the obesity epidemic is a class issue, and also all the self-hating body dysmorphic issues that go with it, they're also part of the class issue. The problem is, what can socialists say or do about any of this, you know, without sounding like these kind of do-gooders and vegan evangelists? So that's my question for today. So over to you.
Very good, Paddy. Article for the Standard there. More or less ready.
I've got a confession to say to make. I did pinch one or two items from old articles in the Standard.
Right. Well, shall we just say a word? I was a bit sort of slightly taken aback by the wording of the written introduction, you know, on the screen, on the what's it called, on the
on Discord,
on the events calendar, yeah, on the events calendar board, just eat shit and diet, food and glass politics, workers are strongly encouraged to stay out of the kitchen, etc. Sorry, can you hear my voice all right?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, all right. Because food is sort of stated to be a class issue, and I know it wasn't deliberate, but that sort of introduction, that written introduction, seems to somehow make a distinct... I know middle class is in scare quotes, but it's sort of, you know, somebody who didn't know the party and who saw that, could easily think we were making a distinction between, you know, people, you know, the horny-handed sons of toil who eat all these nutrition-free microwave meals and so on, and the you know, the sort of so-called middle class, healthy, ethical eating people who are eating better. And the next sentence says that this at base is a class issue. But it is a class issue, but it's not an issue of, as far as I can see, between people eating, workers eating, some workers eating badly, and other workers eating sort of better and more healthily. It's obviously a class issue in the sense that, you know, the capitalist class always have enough to eat, whatever they choose, and whatever they choose to eat, whereas workers, you know, do a lot of the time, but sometimes don't, and in certain parts of the world, often don't. So that's the sort of kind of distinction which possibly should be made clear, and which, you know, we would in our literature make clear normally, rather than sort of try and make this distinction between, you know, some workers choosing to eat sort of, you know, badly and unhealthily, and others healthily or more healthily. Sorry, that was pretty garbled, but hopefully the point got across.
Well, I think I agree, obviously. I mean, the issues of people not being able to get enough to eat, you know, the bottom billion across the world, clearly that's a class issue. But I think in the other aspect, it is fair to say that there is a sort of demographic diet that... that we see, particularly in Britain. And I was trying to say this is maybe just a particularly British thing for historical reasons. Something else I've read not very long ago was that a lot of European countries, especially the Catholic countries, you tend to see families tend to sit down to meals together on a regular basis every day. This is much less the case in Britain. And the article I read tied this in with the fact that Britain is the only country in Europe that has the equivalent of an ASBO. And it has the highest rate of teen violence and young adult antisocial behaviour in Europe. That may be just coincidental rather than causative, but certainly I'm not the only one who thinks that there are class demographics behind what people eat.
Andy, that's probably true. I've seen some studies of the United States in the areas. In some areas, there's no nutritional food on sale locally. It's all processed. In some areas, there's plenty. The rich people can afford to buy food. But quite a lot of working-class communities, the only shops they have to serve them have piled high with processed food. To get, ordinary veg or old-fashioned organic veg, you have to go out of your way. And that's probably similar to what's happened in England. In the local shop, it's a local shop, but it's piled high with sugar, processed food, full of sugar.
Yeah, I just actually wouldn't mind. I'll just quote this. I wasn't going to do it before, but I think it's relevant since Mike's just mentioned sugar. There was a report from 2014, a report from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and they said that sugar interests use every tool at their disposal to obstruct science-based policy on added sugar, and these tools were included intimidating study authors, threatening to suspend funds, using front organisations for the purposes of deception, spreading misinformation, blinding with science in product promotion, concealing industry links, hijacking science communication and blogs, bribing academics, lobbying state policy bodies, and funding pro-food industry politicians. So it's exactly, basically what you're seeing in the food industry is exactly the sort of things that happened in the tobacco industry and in other industries too, most likely. So the fact of manipulation through, particularly things with blinding with science, these are other things that affect the sort of class demographic as well, because, people who've got the sort of educational background to be able to go and investigate for themselves and research for themselves are less likely to be deceived by these kind of tactics.
Yeah, you said it there, Paddy. It's not really class demographics. It's educational demographics that dictate whether people choose to eat sort of one kind of food or another.
But if you look at the statistics on obesity, you're looking at the majority of obesity is in at the sort of bottom end of the income spread, and also the same thing with education.
That's it. Yeah. I think we're agreeing with each other. Yeah.
I'd like to say something here about the. Class or whatever. Our experience is Turkey, where we see the cheap supermarkets, which are absolutely crammed full of all the processed things you can think of, aisles and aisles and aisles of it, plus all the sugary drinks and biscuits, sweets. Snacks, sweets, all that kind of stuff. And real food is very hard to find in there. Yes, they've got some. It's very hard. But it's definitely down to people's budget. They go in there because they can afford the things. And, yes, they load it with all the nasty stuff. But the sort of or upmarket supermarkets. They can't afford to shop in there anyway, where they still have some of this stuff, but they're more, much, much more balanced to a diet of, you know, fruit, vegetables and meat. And the outcome of this on the health issues you mentioned briefly is that the two biggest health issues here are diabetes and heart. That's right, isn't it, Alan?
Yeah. Obesity.
Yeah, obesity is huge here. Obesity is huge, but and that linked also to the diabetes thing. So it for me, it's very much linked to earning capacity.
It's interesting as well, isn't it? Because it depends on what area of the world you're in. Because I've just spent 4.5 months in Cambodia, and there were very few supermarkets, and the ones that were around were very expensive, selling lots of processed foods. Mainly people ate rice and vegetables and eggs, and everything seemed to be always cooked from scratch. So their diet was actually really, really, really good. And people seem generally, even though they were very poor, to be relatively physically fit.
Could I say something? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, yeah.
Well, I read recently in the paper that there are 2,500 malnourished children in England. I don't know if any other members saw that. Nothing's been said on the news or the radio since, and this was, I think, last week, the iPaper.
I'm surprised at that. I would have thought there were far more.
I'm not. I agree. Yeah. I agree. A lot more.
500, yeah.
It's not new. I used to work in after-school play centres for children before they started charging £10 a child in the 1990s. And of course it was, you know, poor children just couldn't afford it, particularly if they had brothers or sisters. £10 a child for a play centre. But the children were coming in hungry then. I mean, it's a bloody disgrace. I don't know what else to say. Excellent topic though, whoever thought of this.
I'll just add, I've just Googled this, and Jacqueline's quite right, but it's even worse than she describes, because these aren't 2,500 children who are malnourished. These are 2,500 children who are hospitalised because of malnourishment.
I didn't see that bit. It's a disgrace. It really is. The money thing. Does anyone remember who wrote about the good stuff in food, not sugar and all this nonsense? I think his name was Amartya Sen, academic.
Yeah, Amartya Sen, S-E-N.
Decades ago, when I used to do university and all that sort of stuff, he wrote about it's not so much being given food or getting food, it's the amount of vitamins and, you know, the stuff that you need, the calories that you need to maintain your body and stuff like that. I've kind of like forgotten, but somebody might know what I'm talking about. That's all I wanted to say.
Jacqueline, you're quite right, but most of the processed food has most of that nutrition taken out of it.
Correct.
Either overcooked or, you know, just actually taken out. And this is one of the reasons why when, you know, 30 years ago, 1986, I went totally organic. Because it's natural. I grew up on natural organic stuff in the 50s for all the processed food things. So, yeah, this is one of the reasons why I don't touch what I call canteen food anymore.
Well, sometimes it is tasty, let's be honest. There's nothing like a full English, is there?
I wouldn't know. I haven't taken one for years.
I think that's part of the issue, though, isn't it? Is what Jacqueline's saying is that the junk food actually is sort of, you know, an instant taste hit. Whereas, you know, eating a bowl of boiled cabbage isn't everybody's idea of a good time.
Yeah, it's because they put MSG in it to stimulate your taste buds. So your taste buds thinking that it's a really nice thing. I think it's a really complicated issue that we're talking about today. You know, people can eat crap for a lot of different reasons. I mean, some of them can be historical and cultural. I think you said something about that, Paddy. Partly it's cost, but I'm not convinced that that's necessarily the main consideration. I mean, you know, you can knock up a meal with some pasta and a courgette for pence, or you can get if you eat fish, you can get a tin of sardines, make a meal for two. The tin of sardines costs £1. You just need a few anchovies, some garlic, lemon. And you've got, again, a meal for, well, less than £1 per person. But there are other considerations that are really important. One is people have got to have the time to cook decent food rather than just buying the junk food. They've got to have the knowledge of how to cook. And they've got to have facilities. I mean, if you live in some god-awful place where it's a shared kitchen which is manky and horrible, you're not going to want to go in there and cook. So you've got this whole battery of considerations which lead to people having bad diets. And no doubt being poor is one of the things, but there are all these other things as well.
By the way, Paddy, cabbage is actually very nice. It depends how you cook it. As with food, and maybe that echoes the kind of thing that Lorna was saying earlier about food in Cambodia. It's not so much what the food is as the way it's put together, the way it's prepared.
Never overcook cabbage.
You're suggesting a new
one of my favourite foods.
I'm getting an idea for a new Discord regular event, the Socialist Recipe Guide.
Can someone explain to me, way back in history, I don't know what it was, whether it was the Regency period, or there was a lot of fat blokes and fat women in England, and I mean fat.
They were the rich
ones. This is how they were. The proletariat was skin and bones, and you saw all these fat people dancing around in bustle dresses and cut-off breeches, you know, and they were the aristocracy and all this sort of stuff. You must have seen the pictures in the galleries. So what was going on there? And it obviously wasn't seen as a problem. The problem now is, if you get on public transport in England, I'm talking here now, particularly in London, and someone who is rather large gets on, I mean, it's just incredible. The seats in trains and buses, the public transport itself, are just not large enough. People are getting bigger, and we're getting, I think, taller as well.
Jacqueline,
serious point. Serious point. It's caused problems on public transport.
Jacqueline, to go back to your first point about the era, you know, Regency, how long ago, the Regency or whatever it was, surely, again, that was to do with economics. The rich people could eat all the food they wanted, whether it was lots and lots of meat and fancy stuff, but the proles were very limited in what they could eat, so they would have been eating healthier food than they are now, I'm sure, but they wouldn't have had enough of it. That's my thought on that one.
Thank you, Janet.
Jacqueline, your point about public transport is that those measurements were right for the 1950s.
Correct. I was just thinking that.
They haven't changed since, but the people have.
Oh, it's like getting on miniature toy. It's like getting on toy trains and things. You're just squashed, and it causes problems. I'm surprised there haven't been pandemics before, to be honest, particularly rush hour.
Mm.
I mean, sorry, in the wartime or just after the war, I remember rationing as a child. And I was born in the 1953, but we still had rationing. And every child in school, I never saw a large child, if you know what I mean. Mind you, I never saw a black one either. And I was in London. I was the only one in my school. But we were washboard thin. You could count our ribs. I mean, you can still count mine, but every child was like that. Yet the food, I keep being told by various studies, was more nutritious, which it probably was, but not enough of it.
Also at that time, they really hadn't got into the number of processed foods that we have now. Yeah, you know, I was a child before you were, Jacqueline.
Correct, okay. Correct.
And I remember that time. But the diet was healthier post-war than it is
and
now.
And we exercised on bomb sites.
Yes, you walked to school, you know, you walked everywhere. Yes, that's right. But the other thought is, why so much of the food is pushed down people's throats? I would say it's pushed down people's throats by mega advertising, isn't it? By the big companies.
Uh-huh. Are you there, Jan?
I am.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
Yeah, but trouble is, I forget what I was going to say. Advertising, I think, is now such an enormous thing in all kinds of areas, isn't it? Whether television and whatever it is, and the companies are going to be wanting you to eat the stuff they are producing, and just sort of normal not unpolluted food, unprocessed food. Well, you don't get adverts for those, do you? It's the pre-made food that's going to be pushed at you all the time. That's where they want their profits from you.
Correct. And they start with the babies. They start with new mothers. You used to get a package. As soon as you gave birth in hospital, there was a box of nappies, baby formula, blah, blah, blah. They tell you on one hand that it's educational and healthy to breastfeed your baby, yet they shove this formula crap at you all the time. Of course, it's convenient over here to stuff a bottle in a baby's mouth rather than your breast. But go abroad, that they've flooded Africa, India, with this baby formula food, you know, dried milk and all this sort of stuff. You know, and the sweet sugared Ribenas, and I'll name them because they've been in the papers, being done for the sugar content, and yet they're still pushing the same stuff. It starts from practically in the womb. Did anyone hear that?
Yeah, we can hear you, Jacqueline. Yeah.
Sorry, because my phone keeps cutting out.
Yeah, I can't really comment on the advertising stuff because I haven't seen a TV advert for over 15 years. I don't look at television because I don't like it being, to me it's just programming, but a lot of people do. I suppose it's just the programming that, you know, you reach for it and you go to a supermarket, oh, that looks nice, I've seen that on the television, I'll buy it, you know. But I don't, I'm unusual, I don't see TV, so I don't know what the programming's like these days.
Well, I have an issue with some of the what's in the foodstuffs. They always tell you to read the contents, what's in it. But, I mean, you need a science degree. There are words there I've never seen, beginning with Z and beginning with X and, you know, stuff like this. What the sodding hell is it? What is in the food?
Well, I mentioned this earlier, that there have been several attempts to make food packaging ingredients and calorie information more accessible.
I think
those attempts have been prevented on some occasions. The traffic lighting system, which was finally brought in, was blocked for years by the food industry. I mean, the food industry is a very powerful cartel, and they don't do what government says. Basically, government does what they say. And so they managed to block the traffic light system for years. But they're still doing the same thing with blinding people with science by putting all kinds of terms in that they know people won't understand. So they're factually correct, but they're still misleading by the nature of them.
What about fluoride chicken? What is all that about?
That's a bit of a hoax, actually, because the argument was that fluoride in chicken was less healthy or safe than because it's an American process. It just makes it last longer. From what I read about it, it was put about that this was an unhealthy American practice by I think anti-Brexiteers who wanted to preserve the European market where they don't do it, and so it was a kind of attempt to head off Donald Trump's attempt to flood Britain with cheap American chicken. So it was a bit of a propaganda tactic. As far as I understand it, there isn't really any difference whether they use fluoride or not. There's no health implications of it, but it's just been one of those things that's been put around as a bit of propaganda.
I disagree with that, Paddy. I mean, there is well known negative effects of excessive fluoridation. There's probably not enough in the chicken to cause a problem. But because of the extent of the fluid, the amount of fluid in other foods in the water supply in many districts, it actually does add up eventually to something which can cause health problems.
Well, sure. I mean, fluorine was a gas used in the First World War. So, I mean, too much of anything will be damaging. But the devil's in the detail, you know, exactly how much is being used without going into it. You know, you could be right, but my feeling is that this is one of these stories it's put around, as I say, mainly for propaganda purposes.
Well, I kind of agree with that it probably is, but that doesn't actually detract from the fact that it also is potentially a health hazard.
Which is ironic, isn't it, considering that we're stuffing ourselves full of sugar and fat, and yet everybody's talking about fluoride, as if that's the biggest health concern of all.
Well, a lot of people are talking about sugar as well. I mean, as Jacqueline was saying, I mean, that there are about 25 different ways that sugar is actually described on labels with all kinds of names that you know, sort of a lot of people will simply not recognize. You know, I mean, it's not that we're talking about fluoride to the exclusion of sugar. I mean, the whole issue about sugar is still a very live one in the kind of debates that I get into.
What you've just been talking about with the chicken, the fluoride, it makes me thinking really again about the economics of eating other foods. Let's take meat, for instance. You have to be fairly wealthy to be able to eat organic meat, stuff that hasn't been produced in a factory. That's chicken. It's very difficult, really, to get chicken that isn't produced in a horrible way. And all the other animal meats. So it seems to me that if you've got plenty of money, you can always eat more healthily, stuff that isn't filled full of nasty things, hormones, whatever it is. It really comes down to the capitalism, doesn't it? That whatever they're doing is to make profit. Some people are going to make profit out of the organic, and the majority are going to make profit out of the cheap and nasty processed food.
Somebody pointed out to me once when they were, he said, you know, when you fry up a rasher of bacon, I'm a vegetarian, but I can remember this. And he said, you know, when you fry up some rashers of bacon for breakfast and you get this kind of weird white scum on it that comes off it. And what do you think it is? And I said, well, I don't know. Is it the fat? And he says, no, because fat doesn't melt like that. It doesn't form a white scum. Do you know, the white scum is actually the antibiotics in the meat. Well, if I'd been a bacon eater at that point, I think that might have put me off.
Well done, Paddy. You may have put some other people off as well.
I'm just to add to the point about you have to be wealthy to eat organic meat, but you also have to be pretty wealthy to eat vegetarian. I mean, it amazes me that vegetarian sausages are often more expensive than meat sausages. You wouldn't believe that. Just seems completely the opposite of common sense or logic, but that's capitalism for you.
What's a vegetarian sausage?
Say again.
What's a vegetarian sausage?
What is a vegetarian sausage? Ah, well, maybe it's the thing that maybe you don't have these things in Turkey, but we have a lot of vegetarian pretend meat products in this country now and in America. And so you get veggie burgers, veggie sausages, absolutely all sorts of things. Quite amazing. But they come at a cost. And the original meat versions are generally much cheaper.
Paddy, no, they're not that expensive, and most of them taste pretty good, actually. That's my experience, anyway.
Well, if you look at the price of veggie sausages and you look at the price of the cheapest meat sausages, the meat sausages are always cheaper.
Well, the moral is don't eat sausages of any kind, meat or vegetarian. Just get hold of that courgette and make some pasta with it and grate a bit of cheese on it.
I don't want courgette socialism. I want sausage socialism. Just another interesting thing that I noted. I remember reading, I don't know if anybody's read Peter Ackroyd's History of England. I think I've read all six volumes now. It's hugely entertaining stuff. He's got all sorts of little gossipy things in it. Although he's a bit right-wing, he's no Marxist historian or anything, but he says in the first volume that analysis of, they've done analyses of bones from the crypts of monasteries from the, you know, the Middle Ages, and they've compared those with the bones they've dug up from city churchyards. And what the analysis of the bones shows is that townspeople in the Middle Ages tended to have bone conditions that you associate with malnutrition, while the monks had problems that seemed to suffer from problems with obesity. And somewhere he found, I wish I could find the list, he provided a list of the weekly allowance, food allowance, to an average monk. And it was absolutely gigantic what they were allowed to have, far in excess of anything that any of us would eat today. So no wonder they were famously fat, like Friar Tuck.
Are we getting anywhere near answering the question that Paddy raised in the blurb for this FAQ? At the level of socialist propaganda, how do we address these issues? I mean, Howard picked up on talk about middle class preoccupations, but within the working class, as we understand it, that is how people themselves see it. I mean, I'm reminded of the parents who were shoving beef burgers through the reins to their kids in school when there was a drive to get the kids to eat more healthily. How do we address issues like that?
I don't think we can. I mean, it's one of the sort of countless problems that capitalism throws up in one form or another. And if we sort of become immersed, I'm not suggesting that this is what you're proposing, Keith, but if we become immersed in the sort of, you know, the sort of small details of, you know, the differences in the way that members of the working class comport themselves and, you know, within capitalism, you know, it's a road that we don't want to go down. So, I mean, several weeks ago, the talk I gave was based on a book which has recently been written to do with food, that book called Cetopia. And in it, the author sort of argued that we could get a better society. It was a sort of anarchist society, actually, but it wasn't sort of that far away from the kind of thing that we're advocating. I'm afraid money was still there, all right. But, you know, it was sort of, you know, better than many plans. And you know, she seemed to think that if people ate better and communally and so on, that would sort of bring us together and, you know, somehow create a better, more fraternal, more caring society. Well, maybe it would, but it still wouldn't be the kind of thing that we would want to advocate.
One thing that I think it's true. We can't be in the position of telling people what they can and can't eat. We're not moralists in that sense. But what I think we could do is we could tell people what kind of food we think socialism would produce and what it probably wouldn't produce and why not. And why, you know, why capitalism creates this shit food in the first place. You know, I think it might be quite a good antidote to this kind of, you know, undeferred gratification of the instant sugar hit, the instant food hit. If we focus on how the food industry manipulates demand and manipulates people's desires, because if there's one thing that's really infuriating about any addiction, it's realizing how you're being manipulated in your addiction. I think that people might respond quite well to that.
Good point, Paddy.
Oh, that seems to have shut everybody up.
Yes. I think it's because you're talking too far into the future. I wouldn't like to speculate what we might be doing in 10, 20 years' time. There's too many variables involved in this.
I was sort of going over in my mind what it would be like at that, what you call the transition time, when the majority have decided that's where we're going. Socialism is what it is. And we discover that we're not paying for, we don't buy our food, we just take our food. And what people will be wanting to take at that stage. I mean, I know it's impossible to really know anything about it, but obviously we will have had time, people will have had time to think about all kinds of aspects of this. It's almost like, what would you be looking forward to when you know you don't have to buy it anymore?
The same things I would buy now. Pure organic food as much as possible. Nothing else.
I was recently worrying about the fact that people are sort of one effect of the you know food consumer culture, fast food, takeaways, and that sort of thing is people forgetting, you know, the basic food skills, food preparation skills, cooking, baking, that sort of thing. I remember thinking about that recently, but how the pandemic has turned that on its head. Suddenly, you know, everybody's become a home baker. You couldn't get flour or yeast in anywhere for weeks on end. So I think that's a sign that things can change more rapidly than you expect. You know, that it may be that you know, people don't choose to cook, but they can learn pretty damn quick if they need to.
Yeah, well, they did thousands of years ago. They learned how to cook. So, you know, I don't suppose there'd be too much. It'll be, depending upon what the biosphere is like, when we ever do get a socialist society, what's left of it and what's, you know, there's so much could go wrong. We'd end up, like that science fiction novel, you know, where you only had a sort of green mass of something or other, I don't know what it was called, made from...
Soylent green.
Yes, made from seaweed or something, you know. There were so many people and there was no it had to be, you know, had to be manufactured, had to be grown.
I wonder if anybody knows, who was the person who first said that capitalism appropriates our skills and then sells them back to us? I think it's a really apt quote for what's happened with cooking skills, preserving skills, the fact that a couple of generations ago it was much more common for people to make their own clothes. But, I mean, Paddy's right, these things can be put into reverse, and certainly in the case of baking, they have been just recently. I know I was trying to get hold of some fucking yeast and I couldn't.
Yes. Right. Can I ask, I'm silent now, but there's 1, 2, 3, there's 8 people here or 9. Just as a matter of curiosity, have any of them eat meat? I mean, flesh or fowl or, you know, a fish. Many people still eat meat.
Yeah, I eat meat, always organic.
I eat meat because I have to. I've tried being vegetarian and vegan, and I just lose weight by the pound very quickly, and I'm not that big, and I just get very ill very quickly if I don't. I'd quite like not to, but I haven't got that choice. But I always eat meat. I always eat organic, yeah.
We eat some meat. Some of it may be organic and some of it isn't.
What do you draw from that then, Mike?
Not many people eat meat in the Socialist Party.
Well, there's Dougie, but he's being very quiet at the moment.
Yes, I've noticed that, though, with the food at conference and the head office. 10 years ago, it was all meat and it was the occasional vegetarian one. In recent years, half vegetarian, half meat. So we have more people.
Well, that's just basic economics, though, isn't it? Because everyone can eat the vegetarian stuff, whereas not everyone can eat the meat stuff. So you're less likely to waste stuff.
Right.
I just blame Paddy. I thought it was all his fault.
I'd love to think so.
That's only a rumour Adam put out.
There has been quite a bit of socialism as well, hasn't there?
Sorry, say that again, because we didn't quite catch that.
There's been a big surge in veganism, which is interesting in terms of what you were saying about vegetarian sausages, Paddy, because I've noticed that the price of them has actually shot up since veganism seems to have become quite a popular thing.
Mm. Yeah, well, you can get vegan ones now. They're even more expensive than the veggie ones, aren't they? Yeah, it's a wonderful example of capitalism cashing in on a trend. You know, whether the trend lasts, I don't know, but there is a bit of a vegan trend in the last couple of years, there has been, with Veganuary and all that sort of stuff. So, the food industry, you know, sees it as an exploitable trend and, of course, you know, charges the premium price.
Well, it's very much what the Michael Moore film showed, wasn't it, about the green agenda. Capitalism has espoused that and, used it to its own advantage, as was predictable, of course.
But, of course, if the veganism or veggieism, you know, became popular, which it still isn't, I mean, it's only about, I think, 5% of people in the population are vegetarian. You know, but if it became a popular thing, then the price would tend to fall by the normal kind of process of capitalism.
Yeah, but the normal process of capitalism means that we're going to have a recession for most of the members of the working class, so they're going to be less money to spend on anything over the next year or two or three.
There's another thought I have here. Looking at different, nationalities, really, different nations, different areas of the world, and how things do vary onto what the majority of the population will be eating in these different places, where some will be meat eaters, some will be fish eaters, some will be very much vegetable eaters. Sometimes through religion and sometimes just through many, many years of the way things develop. I can't help but notice because we haven't been in the UK for so long that, of course, what most of you talk about is what's happening there, where that you have less than 1% of the world's population. For socialism, we need to be looking very broadly different ways of approaching the food situation.
Yeah, if I can just cut in here, because, you know, what Janet's just said about different things in different parts of the world, here in Turkey, here in the, you know, where we live in the southwest of the country, it's extremely fertile. By and large, the climate is moderate. They can grow two crops of tomatoes a year, for example, in a season, or even three. Now, you go over to the east, and as you go towards the east, up into the mountains, you're talking about extremely harsh climatic conditions, minus 30, minus 40 in the winter. And the growing season is so short that they are predominantly meat eaters. And you will see great herds of goats and sheep being brought up in the summertime to graze the pastures. But the local people, one of the things that they do, and you see masses of them, they raise geese, because geese will graze. They live on grazing. They're easy to keep. And come the winter time, as the winter is approaching, they kill the majority of them, prepare them, and they have their refrigerators are literally tubs buried into the ground, because with the temperature going down, it will freeze the carcass, and they will use that during the course of the winter. Their vegetable intake is much less. It costs a lot of money to bring fresh vegetables or salad crops or whatever up from the coastal plains into the mountains and the high plateaus of Anatolia. And the other thing I would say about, we always, since we came here, have lived in rural community. And the local people, the villagers, are in the main. Yes, they may work, for example, in this part of the world, in tourism as a job for 5 or 6 months of the year if they're lucky. But they are nearly all of them raising chickens. They have a goat or two. They have a cow, and they grow their own vegetables. They grow their own cereals. They take their cereal to a local miller, on an industrial estate these days. And life is like they are more capable of surviving than people living in the metropolitan urban areas, where they have no idea where food comes from in the main, apart from the fact that it's on the shelf or in the refrigerator in the supermarket. So we're much closer to it here. Next weekend, they have one of the major Muslim festivals. Many of you will probably know. It's the Korban Bayram, as they call it here, which is the Feast of the Sacrifice. And people will have raised or will buy an animal for slaughter to celebrate that feast. It's very important to them in terms of, in the same way that Christmas is in the social, in the Western world. So we get some interesting insights.
Yeah, I think I would kind of echo that, really. I think it's often, and what really struck me during the time in Cambodia was that, you know, there was this real, they talk about, you know, it is the developing world, by which they mean developing capitalism. And, you know, as I was saying, back to diet, because the majority of people live in rural communities, largely growing rice and various other crops, and the same with chickens as well, lots and lots of chickens. So, you know, they tend to use a lot of eggs in cooking. But it was sad, really, that when we first arrived and we were talking to people, especially local people, that for them, they really wanted us to take us to the city and show us where the Burger Kings were. That's it, really.
I think a point to make about what kind of land will support what kind of crop, to follow Alan's point. Yeah, I mean, there are certainly areas where the type of terrain won't support commercial food crops. So for example, in Britain, you've got some parts of Britain that are mainly sheep or dairy farming. But that's not because the land won't support other types of food production, but because it won't support large scale commercial food production. So for example, where I live in the northwest, it's a lot of it's too hilly for tractors or combine harvesters. So you can't grow large commercial crops. So that's why it's giving over to meat farming. But in socialism, you've got other options. You could have food production that was in small holdings. You could have a lot of small holdings. I mean, I suspect that a lot more people would be directly involved in food production in some sense, like people who have allotments. You could produce a lot more food in small holdings, which can be on any type, practically any type of terrain. And that gets away from the large scale monocropping that is part of the reason why we've got such a bad problem with soil erosion.
I think that's a really good point. And the way in which commercial farming impacts. But there's also the bureaucratic effect on farming, because my family are Irish, and a number of years ago I was in Kerry, and the EC had completely destroyed farming in Kerry, because what they'd done is that they had sort of, with a wave of the hand, they had designated Kerry as a sheep farming area. They plotted out various, the common agricultural policy, and they plotted out areas where certain crops or certain stock should be grown. And these sheep replaced the Kerry cows. Now, the Kerry cows had actually been bred over generations because they were very light croppers. And on the very thin soil in Kerry, that actually maintained the grass, whereas the sheep that were actually placed there sheep are very deep croppers, so they crop very closely down to the roots. And they just, within years, in fact, they simply destroyed all the grasslands. And nothing then could actually survive on that area. And the farmers ended up living on subsidies because they could no longer actually feed themselves. So it's a lesson also in, you know, that we need to be aware of local cultures and local traditions that have grown up, because they may actually be very, very closely and ecologically related to the land.
I think that's been a very interesting session.
And certainly food for thought.
I once saw somebody wearing a T-shirt. It said, "Eating is an agricultural act."
I once had a T-shirt. I got fed up with food fadism, you know, sort of people taking it to extremes. So I once had a T-shirt which actually said that nothing will kill you faster than food.
Well, on that note, I think it's probably time to call it a day on this FAQ.